Support for this public radio podcast comes from AIG Travel Guard, providing travel insurance designed to help travelers face the unexpected. Learn more at travelguard.com.
I'm Dick Gordon. Coming up, the story of a young artist who says that his whole life was changed when his cousin was shot in a petty robbery. Hank Willis Thomas says the saddest part of the story is that the young black men who killed his cousin showed him how much they valued life because the holdup netted them nothing but a couple of flashy chains. Hank marked the event in a short animated film.
It's a nice chain. Wish I had a chain like that.
Hey, man, who are you, man?
This chain ain't even real, man.
Stay down. Yo, what'd I do with him?
Yo, just leave him. Just bang him. Just bang him. Just do it.
Hank Willis Thomas now makes his art from the symbols and the logos and the brands that he says continue to turn the black man's body into some kind of commodity. He says it's a continuation of the fight for civil rights. I'll talk with Hank Willis Thomas right after the news. Listening to the news yesterday, we were all reminded that Dr. Martin Luther King was killed 40 years ago. To mark this anniversary, the High Museum of Art in Atlanta has commissioned a number of African-American artists, all of whom were born after King's assassination. They're contributing to an exhibit called After 1968. One of the artists is Hank Willis Thomas, and one of his best-known pieces is a photograph that shows the back of a black man's head with burn scar tissue in the mark of Nike's swoosh. Hank says it's a play on the current practice of the corporate branding of black athletes, something that was a key part of his own childhood, growing up in the shadow of people like Michael Jordan.
I've been picked on sports teams by people who just assume because I'm black, I can play. And I've even had, in front of black people, a white guy tell me, granted I was in high school, but he told me that he was blacker than me because he could dance better, dribble better, and play football better. And the black kids in the room looked around like, well, it's true. Like, so how somehow blackness has kind of been attached to this myth that, you know, we are somehow naturally able in hand-eye coordination or something, but perhaps lacking in other areas.
I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Story.
The Story is produced by North Carolina Public Radio, WUNC. It's co-produced and distributed by American Public Media.
Hank Willis Thomas is an artist who was among those chosen to contribute to this new exhibit called After 1968, Contemporary Artists and the Civil Rights Legacy. Hank says the legacy of Dr. King has played out in his own life. His father was the first black person to bag groceries at the A&P in Florence, South Carolina. And though his mother was told that the best she could hope for was a career as a receptionist, she went on to win a MacArthur for her work in human rights. Hank says his own confidence and success as an artist are due to what his parents went through.
I'm in awe. I really see myself working in my mother's legacy, who works in the legacy of Martin Luther King and Gordon Parks and Langston Hughes and a number of other people. It means what I have to say actually means something.
Hank's recent work is a series called Unbranded, where he looks not at the words but at the images used in magazine advertisements. He says the images on their own tell quite a different story.
I call it How to Market Kitty Litter to Black People from Ebony Magazine 2002. So this one is a picture of a plate on like a wood table, and there's an ice cream scoop and a watermelon. And the unique thing about this specific watermelon is that all of the seeds are in one area.
So it's a slice of watermelon sitting on the plate, right?
It's a slice of watermelon sitting on a plate, and all the seeds are organized in one orderly place right to the front of the, so you could scoop it out. And when you look at it, you're just like, what is this? You can't possibly think what it's an ad for. Watermelon, ice cream scoop. And then when you read the title and you see it's an ad for Scoop Away, which is kitty litter that clumps when it's
It really wet, was an ad for wet. Kitty litter.
Yes, it's an ad for kitty litter. And when you look at it, there is only one logic, that you can deduce. And you're like, okay. Because somebody was aware of the stereotype when they made it. And so they're like, no black kidding. People like watermelon. How do we get them to buy our kitty litter?
What would make
a watermelon better? Exactly. And then if all the seeds were in one place and you could just scoop them away, just like our kitty litter. And I really believe it must have been a black agency or a black person who came up with that campaign, because I couldn't imagine a white person sitting in a room and just being like, you know, this is going to work. I feel like it had to be a black person being like, right? Trust me, I'm black. I love watermelon. No, it'll go over fine. And so I've tried to choose ads that are very, you know, provocative or curious or, you know, shocking. But I've also tried to choose ads that were very mundane. So you see kind of what's changed and you see kind of what hasn't changed.
Hank Willis Thomas says his entire outlook on life changed after the murder of his cousin. The two of them grew up together. Songa, that was his name. Songa says Hank was more like a brother to him.
You know, it's all the cliches. You know, everyone wanted to be like him. He was clever and charismatic and, you know.
Was he older than you?
Yeah, he's 4 years older than me. He was basically like my big brother figure. And he went to boarding school from probably 12, you know, until the end of high school on athletic scholarships. But no matter where he was always this kid that people were drawn to. And I actually got into the same second boarding school that he went to on the auspices that I would also be somehow some kind of great athlete and, you know, student leader. And boy, were they disappointed.
they wanted Sunga too, and they got you, right?
Yeah, I mean, it was pretty funny. But really, whenever we went into a bar or a club, he would always get everybody in for free and always get a free drink. And he would always just do it with a smile. One time there was 13 of us that they let in for just because we were with him. But he just had this kind of joy that people really liked to respond to or something. And growing up under him, people never really paid much attention to me. And he, being tall and strong, and the hope was that he would go to the NBA and play, you know, or be kind of a college basketball coach or some kind of, you know, athlete who was kind of like the prodigal son of the family.
He was a good athlete, was he, Hank?
Yeah, he was a really good athlete. He was really good at everything. Great athlete, great communicator. And I was none of those things. And I think he wished that he were me, and I wished that I were him.
I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Story. Hank Willis Thomas is an artist. His cousin Songa was killed 8 years ago. Hank wasn't there that night. He says the last time the two of them were together, they were quarreling. Hank was 24, Songa 27. And Hank had this strange sense that he needed to make things right before he said goodbye to his cousin.
Something inside me said, give him a kiss because this is going to be the last time you see him alive. And I kind of was just like, eh, I don't want to give him a kiss. And I stood up and gave him like a kind of a half kiss and a hug and left. But when I got outside, I said to my girlfriend at the time, I had a premonition and I just want to put it out there because I don't even really know what a premonition is. But a voice in my head said, this is going to be the last time that I saw Songa alive.
What was Songa's reaction when you kissed him?
It wasn't particularly uncommon.
Yeah, you guys were close enough that that wasn't a strange event, right?
Yeah, we shared, like, even at the time, we always shared a room and sometimes even shared a bed. You know, we just, like, we shared everything.
Yeah.
So it wasn't totally uncommon. But what shocked me is that I actually put it out there in the world and I said that to someone who recalled me saying it because I made a point. And so fast forward a month and him and I were talking on the phone and he's like, Hank, I see it now, you know, I see my purpose. And he just kind of was going on about love and getting this new understanding of his relationship to God and doing things that he wouldn't normally do. So he went to church and like sang in my grandmother's church for the first time in like probably 12 years. He was just like having these kind of epiphanies. And then he woke up at 6 a.m. on February, I guess, 1st, 2000, and had a panic kind of attack. And he called his mother. He's like, Mom, I had a dream that I was shot and somebody told me that that meant that somebody I love was in trouble.
And he was calling his mother because he was afraid someone else had been hurt.
Yeah. And then later that evening, a friend of his from junior high school he hadn't seen in 15 years found out he was in town and called him, asked him to come out. And Songa was usually always going out. As I told you, he was always kind of this life of the party type person. And he just was kind of over that. And the guy called him six times. Like the guy's name is Todd Rose. And he asked him, come on, man. Come on. It'll be just like old times. We'll just play, blah, blah, blah. And my grandmother begged him not to go out. because of the dream, and she was just like kind of freaked out, like, please don't go, please don't go. And Sangha was this person, he just hated to disappoint people. So he went out on a night that he didn't want to go out.
Yeah.
But apparently they went out, they had this, you know, incredible time, and the guys he was with, Todd and Teddy, were wearing these diamond and platinum chains. And as they were leaving the club, Todd saw somebody he knew. Sangha had no coat, so he ran ahead to go to his car to grab his coat. And by the time Todd and Teddy caught up to him, they said Sangha was like 30 feet ahead of them. They saw him laying face down on the snow, and Todd thought that Sangha was doing snow angels, because they, like, when they were kids, you know, they would, like, you know, lay and do snow angels when they were in boarding school and just play together. And they were like, come on, Sangha, get up. And yeah. Then he realized that they were in the middle of a robbery. And they were just like, we're good people, you know, come on, we just had a beautiful night, you know, we know everybody around here, how are you going to rob? The club had just let out, so there was all these people everywhere. And he was like, how are you going to rob us in front of all these people, you know? And the guy kept trying to make Todd and Teddy get on the ground, and they didn't get down. And they took off their chains, and the guy took Todd's watch and Teddy's chain, and Todd just started to run. And he ran, like, back into the parking lot, and Teddy ran behind him. And he says he thought that Sangha was behind him. And he said by the time he got behind the car, he pointed out that he was in the Gulf War. And he's like, and I remember the muzzle flash. He's like, and I saw the muzzle flash go off right close to Sangha's head. And he said he ran, you know, obviously there was like panic, and he ran back to Sangha. He's like, and it was so strange. He's like, nobody was touching him. Nobody was holding him. And he's like, I just went and I just held him. And I don't really know all those details, but the thing that sticks with me is, he's like, nobody was there to hold him. No, everyone was just looking at him. And, you know, they tried to call an ambulance, but basically he was shot in the back of the head while he was laying face down in the snow. And ironically, no one took anything from him. He had the same $20 in his pocket he left the night with, probably because he got free drinks. And he was wearing, I had given him a silver bracelet from Trinidad, and he still had that on. So, you know, the only thing that was robbed from him that night was his life.
I was 8 years ago.
Yeah.
Still with you?
Yeah. My whole art career is kind of based off of him.
Hank Willis Thomas couldn't shake the idea that the thieves thought that a chain had the same value as a human life, and that in such circumstances, young African-American men can treat each other as badly as the slave owners treated the slave. I'll talk with him more about that in just a moment. I'm Dick Gordon from American Public Media. This is The Story. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Story. Hank Willis Thomas is one of seven artists chosen to contribute to a new exhibit called After 1968. All the artists were born after the assassination of Dr. Martin Luther King, and they're all bringing their own perspective to civil rights. Hank says he spent a long time thinking through the murder of his cousin Sangha, a young man who was killed in a robbery. Hank collaborated with an animation filmmaker to recreate the scene of the killing using action figures. It was that same snowy night outside a club in Philadelphia. Three friends are fooling around when they're interrupted.
Yo, is he doing snow angels?
Hey, Sangha. Yo, what are you doing, man? A second ago, you freezing, Mr. Pudding Pot. Now, you rolling around in the snow. We ain't kids no more, man.
Yo, that's a nice chain. Wish I had a chain like that.
Yo, we ain't even got nothing.
Man, give it up.
Hey, man, who are you, man? We all good people here, you know what I'm saying? Yo, are you really trying to rob us in front of all these people, man?
Shut the f*** and give up your s***.
Whoa, man, chill, man, chill. This chain ain't even real, man.
Stay down.
Come on, bro. How you gonna do that to him, man? He just got that chain. How you gonna do that?
Man, just give up your chain.
Yo, what I do with him?
Yo, just leave him. Just bang him. Just bang him. Just do it.
And now it's a winter. Winter in America.
You can stream the Winter in America video from Hank's website. We have a link to it at thestory.org. Hank says it was soon after the killing of his cousin when he decided to go to art school.
When Sunga was killed, and our last argument was over who was following who to California, to San Francisco. And he's like, you're always following me. I was like, no, I'm going to go to art school there. And by the time I got there, it was 6 months after he died, and I was starting California College of the Arts and Crafts in Oakland. And
how were you doing? Were you like trying to start all over again, trying to clear your head? Were you still carrying the grief of his death with you? What state of mind were you in then?
The biggest impact of losing him was that in the family structure, people never really pay that much attention to me, so I could do whatever I wanted. And now, without Sangha, people also gave me a lot of empathy because I knew how close we were. But also, I kind of started having to fill that role as like the... There were two males. Now there was just one.
Now all the expectations are on your shoulders, right?
Correct. And that's what I said when I started graduate school and I introduced myself and my work, was that the purpose of why I made work was forever changed. And I had one professor who said something that seemed insensitive at the time, but it was also true. And he said, you know, I know you don't really want to hear this, but this is going to make you a better artist. And I think it did.
Hank Willis Thomas's thoughts about his cousin's death and the art that he might create had him reconsidering their lives as young men. He thought about growing up in New York, that sense that even as a schoolboy, he was never safe.
There was a time, this is sad, I was seventh grade. I sung in the choir, and there was like a competition that we were going to go compete in Atlanta. And we had to sell chocolate M&Ms to like kind of raise money. And I was picking my friend up from the elementary school across the street, and I had my box of peanut M&Ms. And some kids kind of came up behind me, like, you know, put me in a chokehold and, like, punched me and, like, took all of my boxes of candy, like $30 of candy. And those kind of things happened, or, like, you had a radar. New Yorkers, especially at that time, had this radar that you can tell who's behind you or the danger that you might be in by the pace of the footsteps behind you. So if, you know, the people behind you, you start walking faster, the people behind you start walking faster, you know that you have a certain amount of time before you need to, like, really just, you know, put on the turbo blasters and get out of there.
I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Story. My guest today is the artist Hank Willis Thomas. He says that those threats of violence were the same that led to the killing of his cousin.
All we knew at the time was that Sunga was killed over a chain. And my friend Seth Mann, he said, the worst part about this is that we don't even have to ask whether or not the killers were black, just by the nature of knowing that he was killed over a chain, and that typically only black people kill each other over those kind of things. You know, when you think about it, how stupid it was, you know, how ridiculous it was that they'd already gotten what they wanted.
They'd taken a chance. There was no reason to shoot anyone.
I think it really led me to think about, like, what makes a chain more valuable than a human life, or what is it that would lead someone to want to harm someone after they've already gotten what they wanted? And I think for me, because when you look at the statistics in 2000, but also in 2005, blacks were 6 times more likely to be murdered than whites, and 94% of them were killed by other blacks. When you think that almost all of them were killed by people who look like them, it really, to me, says something that's deeper.
Hank started to play with symbols in his artwork. He took the silhouettes and symbols of famous basketball players and juxtaposed them with guns and ankle chains. His best-known piece is one I talked about earlier. It's called Branded Head. It looks like a photo of a black man's shaved head. There's a Nike swoosh on the back of the head, but it's there in the old style of a slavery brand burned into the skin. Hank says it's an image that comes from the worldwide fame that Michael Jordan enjoyed and the shoes that he wore that everyone, including his cousin, had to own.
Sangha always had Air Jordans, which were like the symbol of either financial status or athletic ability for a lot of young African Americans. And
these were shoes that people would kill for, right? Back in the early 90s?
Yeah, people were getting killed in the late 80s, early 90s for Air Jordans, for triple fat goose coats, and for even JanSport backpacks in New York City. And there were plenty of times that each of us, but Sangha, I recall, like having these kind of adventures where, you know, I remember one time, like, he was playing in basketball somewhere. He was like, and all these guys came and we were like talking, wanting his shoes. And he's like, I thought it was going to be curtains. And which was kind of funny at the time. But to have survived all of those things. And basically what I was really started to think about is like, so he was killed over a petty commodity. The chain my cousin was killed over was sold on the street for $250, which is roughly the price of a pair of Air Jordans back then. And so I started thinking about Michael Jordan and how his shoes, people wanting to walk in his shoes, became such a powerful symbol. And I was wondering, like, how could it be that, you know, the descendant of a slave just maybe three or four generations later is now kind of the global symbol of American transcendence. He kind of transcended race. He transcended, you know, financial boundaries. He transcended athletic boundaries. He transcended national boundaries.
And people look at all this, Hank, as a tremendous achievement, as success. Are you saying
that? I do too. I'm wondering how could that be? And so basically what I started to do is I started looking at people criticize him, not me necessarily, but I know you're in North Carolina, which is his home. but he was highly criticized in 1992, where he covered up his Reebok Olympic jersey with an American flag because his allegiance was to Nike over even the United States in a way.
The suggestion being that he is still kind of beholden to that, right? That that's the most important thing to him.
And I don't know if I blame him. I have never been in that kind of powerful position where, I mean, he was the brand. But I was thinking about how his ancestors who were slaves were branded as a sign of ownership. And now today we brand ourselves in large part because of our desire to emulate the descendant of a slave. I didn't realize I wanted to be an artist until I had almost finished graduate school, I'd already done that branded head image. Because up until then, I was just kind of feeling my way around, just kind of trying to make sense of the world.
But Hank, there must have been a point at which people said, you have a lot of talent. This is important work that you're doing.
My college friends and peers are dumbfounded. You know, they're just like, you? You know, because, you know, I was known for falling asleep in class. But what I really learned was that having people believe in you makes all the difference in the world. No one said you had to do this, you had to do that. They just said, you know, just do something. And I was emboldened by the rappers who, if Lil Wayne or 50 Cent can have an audience of millions of people, you know, then I definitely got something to say, and it's worth it, you know.
What was the moment, though, when you realized that, when you knew that you had something to say and it was worth, you know, showing it to other people?
I really would say the one moment was when I had put up my MFA show, ironically, and people were just actually, like, really responding to the work. My MFA show, I rented a Viacom kiosk, and I had my piece, Absolute Power, Basketball and Chain, and Branded Head. And people were walking by it as if it was just another ad. And they would say things like, I can't believe the school is so corporate. You know, they have Nike and Absolute sponsoring the MFA show. And it clued me in that I was onto something. When people could walk by my, and, you know, after like 3 or 4 days, people actually stopped to look at it and were like, oh, that's not right. You know, but then shrug their shoulders and keep going on. And so I started thinking about things like the NCAA and NBA draft and how, you know, the overwhelming majority of people in those drafts are descendants of slaves. And a lot of things, same things you might want in a team athlete are the same things you might want also in a good slave. You want them to be strong. You want them to be smart, but also able to take orders in a very specific way and not defiant. And, you know, the way that people are talked about on the draft block, I can imagine being somewhat similar to that on the slave block. And I started to really dive into that. And so using Michael Jordan, Nike had infiltrated blackness. You know, it had somehow become a part of the black experience. So the branded head image, to me, talks about all of those things about our how we subconsciously brand ourselves. And we, not just African-Americans, but we as people in the media savvy world, live in a state of branded consciousness.
There's another one of your pieces that I wanted to get you to describe, and this is, you're probably better at describing it than I am. This is the one you call NBA Trade. You know the one I'm talking about?
Yes. And that one actually was a slave poster from 1853 where it says, wanted, in big letters, the undersigned will pay $1,000 to $1,200 for likely Negroes more than any other slave trader in the South. And basically, I removed the image of the slave that was on the poster and put in the NBA logo. So I was really just trying to really make that correlation between the way that black bodies or the athletic bodies, you know, are traded on these markets.
Anyone take you on for this, Hank? Anyone, African-American or white, say, you're over the line with this?
I mean, but how could you? I mean, especially when you bring up the NCAA, where people basically work for free for a multi-million-dollar corporation. It's kind of insane. And some people have said, though, that, you know, these professional athletes get paid. And I can only think to reference Master P, who's a rapper, when he was first offered a $10 million contract. He's like, if they're offering me $10 million, I must be worth $100 million. And it's true that, like, the amount of money that's being made off, like, isn't Michael Jordan getting divorced now and, you know, he's only worth, like, $300 million? And you're like, Michael Jordan? You know, Nike's a $10 billion company and the man who's most closely associated is only worth $300 million.
Yeah,
You
do the math, right?
I mean, and that's, you know, that's what he's got, how many endorsements. But when you think about how much money is being made off of these guys, it's, and so I did another piece called Basketball and Chain, where it's just the legs of a black athlete. He's jumping out of the picture.
Yeah, all you see is the chained, legs.
Yeah, and he's chained to a basketball. And for me, that speaks to that idea that for so many people, you know, especially for a lot of young African-American men, the idea of ascension is chained to sports or some form of entertainment, where we don't so often see the people promoted in our community who are just like regular people who have a good job and a realistic outlook on success.
You're listening to The Story. I'm Dick Gordon. One of Hank Willis Thomas's pieces of art is a banner that's 14 feet high and 22 feet long, the same size as any kind of street-side billboard. It's a black and white image from his cousin's funeral, showing the faces of family members grieving. The words superimposed over the photo say, three-piece suit, $250, new socks, $2, gold chain, $400, 9mm pistol, $79, bullet, 60 cents. Picking the perfect casket for your son, priceless.
I took 5 pictures at the funeral. They were all actually outside when we were burying him. I took these pictures and I didn't know what to do with them. I felt hopeless. That's when I realized I had to be more than just a photographer who recorded things. I had to try to say something because I just, like, this image alone isn't saying enough. And so 4 years later, I brought that image from 2000 back to life, I guess, by using the language of the MasterCard Priceless campaign. You know, I recall being in the funeral home with my aunt and we could choose between the $2,500 casket, which is a box of wood that's going to be thrown in the dirt, or the $7,000 casket, which is a box of wood that's going to be thrown in the dirt. You know, the kind of the hidden context is you love him more if you buy the $7,000 box than you do if you buy the $2,500 box. And it was this kind of impossible decision I saw my aunt and my mother having to make. And I was just like, I left because my aunt doesn't have a lot of money and I couldn't stand to watch her have to make that decision, you know. So I was thinking that even in mourning, we're being marketed to. I love advertising, and I love how it can say so much with so little. But the irony of, I know whatever decision my aunt and my mother made, it wound up going on credit cards. So it kind of ties it all together, in my opinion.
When do you think the grieving for your cousin will end? I mean, I get a sense listening to you talk about him that you're still grieving to a certain extent, and I don't mean it in a way that's all-consuming, but what do you think?
I mean, I don't think the grieving will ever end. I'm trying to make a distinction between mourning and grieving. I think the mourning period where I was just totally down in the dumps was 2 whole years, where even up until 5 years after he died, I'd wake up, even the past, like a few weeks ago, like I wake up and I think it's a dream that he's dead. You know, I mean, I'm now older than he was, so I have wisdom that he never was able to have. And that's just, you know, it's dumbfounding. And so I think about him every day, all day. But I feel like now that I'm an artist and I have this career and I've somehow managed to make money talking about these things that are important to me, there's a delicate line between, you know, respecting and loving and paying homage to someone and making a whole career out of it. And I'm trying to kind of cross into that next territory, that next place where I can make work that's still meaningful and profound, but it doesn't so much draw from this personal experience.
You still talk to him?
Who, my cousin?
Mm.
Yeah. I mean, pretty much every day. I mean, I do. My aunt does. I mean, he was that person that, you know, could always make you smile whenever anything was going wrong, you know. So, yeah. Especially when I'm down, you know, wish upon a star.
What do you mean, wish upon a star?
You know, sometimes I'll, at nighttime, I'll look up and look at a star and imagine that, you know, shooting star and imagine that it's him. You know, I'll play that game like, okay, if you're out there, be a star that shoots across the sky in the next 10 seconds. And that's going to happen if you look close enough.
Hank Willis Thomas is contributing to a new show that's being put together called After 1968, Contemporary Artists and the Civil Rights Legacy. We have a number of images of his artwork on our website. And of course, if you want more, we have a link to Hank's site. It's all at thestory.org. I'm Dick Gordon from American Public Media. This is The Story. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Story. We've all seen too many of them, the emails that promise us instant wealth and our share of millions of dollars for doing next to nothing. I'm so tired of them, I just hit the delete button and move on. A week or so ago, I talked with Dan Giddens. He got himself mixed up in one of these email scams. He told me that he was unemployed at the time, bored, and, well, perhaps a little naive. That's why he responded to an offer to receive some checks from Africa, an offer that seemed too good to be true.
Online, through the email, there were explicit directions of what to do. I was to cash them. They would send me 10%, and I would have to send these to Nigeria in Africa.
Now, along about this point, my antenna would go up.
Well, yeah, the antennas were up, and I'm thinking, well, let's see where it goes from here.
Where it wound up eventually was in the hands of the Rhode Island police. Dan was lucky that the detective was willing to let him off with a warning. My next guest responds to these scam emails on a regular basis, but not because he's gullible. He's out to get the scammers. Mike Berry is a computer engineer who lives in Manchester, England. His mission is to out-scam the email fraud artists. It began about 4 years ago when he got an email that he knew immediately was not legit.
And then one day in a 24-hour period, the same guy emailed me with his scam about a dozen times, half a dozen or a dozen or so times, and he sort of drove me to insanity. So I thought, well, for once, I'm going to hit reply and give this guy a piece of my mind and tell him that I know exactly what his scam's all about. So I hit reply, told him exactly what he could do with his scam, and thought, well, that's the last I'm ever going to hear from him. But to my surprise, the next day he emailed me. He mustn't have read everything I said to him, but he emailed me with a copy of his fake passport and a fake deposit certificate showing that he had $18 million in a bank ready to send to me. Not having ever done this before, I was quite surprised how far he would let me push him, what crazy demands he would let me do of him, sending in, you know, silly photographs of himself holding up silly signs and things like that.
Give me an example, if you would, Mike, of a photograph, how you get someone, wherever they are, to pose for you.
Well, what they will inevitably do, they will send us a fake passport as their means of identifying themselves to us, we will turn that back on them and say, well, look, we know how easy the, you know, I really do believe you and I want to believe you, but we know how easy these passports are to forge. So here's a foolproof way of proving who you are to me. How about you take a photograph of yourself holding up a sign with our agreed password on it? And of course, our password tends to be something stupid, you know, like I'm a thief in disguise or something like that, or, you know, I love sheep or something to that. They think they're sending a password.
I want to go a little bit deeper into one of these photographs. There was an exchange that you had with one scammer where you actually got him to join some made-up church. The Holy Church of the Order of the Red Breast.
Yes, the Order of the Red Breast, yes. This guy contacted me with the usual scam. I've got millions of dollars I'd like to put into your bank account. I replied back to him saying, you know, I would be interested in your offer. However, you know, I belong to the Church of the Painted Breast and we cannot do business with people who are not of our faith. If you're willing to join our church, then by all means, we'd be happy to try and help you out. And of course, he replied back, seeing the money at the end of the rainbow, and saying, "Well, yes, I'd you know, be happy to join your church." Of course, we had an induction procedure whereby to join the church, you had to take a photograph of yourself topless with your right breast painted with a red church logo and send it in to us, as well as filling in various question and answer forms full of silly and stupid questions. And he duly did that. He sent that in. And then we proceeded with the scam as normal. And then it got to the part where he was asking me for fees, which at the time turned out to be $18,000. Well, I told him, well, I could get that from the church account, wouldn't be a problem whatsoever. But unfortunately, I would be charged an $80 early withdrawal fee. And being a poor churchman, I couldn't afford these fees. But if you're happy to pay these fees on my behalf, then by all means, I can get the money that you require.
But hang on a second. I want to make sure that I understand this. You're now actually asking the scammer to send you money?
Exactly. He wants $18,000. I've told him, basically, I can get the money for you, but we have to pay an $80 early withdrawal fee. He said, right, no problem at all. And he actually sent me the $80 in cash.
No kidding.
I've since donated that to charity. Obviously, I don't want to keep scammers' money. And he expected then that this $18,000 would immediately be sent to him. Of course, there were all sorts of things that happened on the way. Halfway through, just after he'd sent the money, I told him that I'd lost all faith in the church. A friend of mine had died, a dear friend that had made me lose all faith in the church. And I decided to leave the church and join a travelling circus as a clown. And I sent him lots of mocked-up photographs of me with all my clowning buddies. And we kept this going on for, I think, about 7 or 8 months before he sort of just held up his hands in exasperation, I think, and stopped replying to me.
I can't believe you actually got him to send you money, though.
I mean, quite a few times, on quite a few occasions, scam baiters, which is what we call ourselves, we've had them do that. I mean, nowadays, we certainly don't recommend that anybody tries to do that. It's a very dangerous thing to do. There's one thing, you know, making fun out of these guys, but actually depriving them of cash is another thing entirely. And of course, you've got the legal grey area as well. Even though the guy is a scammer, you're essentially scamming that guy out of money. So technically speaking, it is breaking the law. Whether, you know, any judge would send you down for that is another thing entirely.
You're listening to The Story. I'm Dick Gordon. Mike Berry runs an anti-scamming website called 419eater.com. The 419 refers to a section of the criminal code in Nigeria that's supposed to cover this kind of mail fraud. Mike told me that when he began his website, he saw this kind of scam baiting as a big joke. But as time went on, he began to realize that it's no joke to the people who are getting defrauded. Still, he confesses even now that there are days when he really enjoys his work.
I suppose one of the later ones that was the most fun was the guy I got to actually record himself reading the entire Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy book from start to finish. He recorded, he went to a little studio, sat down with the book and read it from page 1 to page 350 or whatever it was. That was great because I know that, you know, the guy that I was speaking to on the phone is the same voice that's on the tape that he sent to me. So I know he hadn't employed some sort of innocent guy to actually do the work for him. I know it was the actual scammer.
I read about this in on your website, this reading of the book. And you know what got me, Mike, was it took you so long to get yes. him to do that. He was always coming up with reasons why he couldn't find a DJ friend or he couldn't send exactly. an MP3. And you just kept at him. You just, I mean, yeah. you nibbled him to death.
It's what you've got to do. And the key is to get these guys to do what you want, you've really got to convince them that you're the guy with the money and you're stupid enough to part with it. You know, the more money he thinks he's going to get at the end of the day, obviously the more hoops they're going to jump through. I mean, again, there's another story where I got a guy to carve a wooden Commodore 64. That arrived for me, and then I edited the picture up. I photoshopped the Commodore 64 to show that a rat had gnawed into it and ruined it. So I sent the pictures back to him and said, look, I can't accept this. This is, you know, this is diabolical. So the guy then actually sent a carving of my own head. I sent him photographs of my head, and he actually managed to carve it and sent me the head. And in the end, I managed to get the guy to act out the Monty Python dead parrot sketch and video it for me.
I wish to complain about this parrot that I bought not half an hour ago from this very shop.
Oh, yes, the Norwegian blue. What's wrong with it?
I will tell you what's wrong with it. It's dead.
You've got to keep these guys busy with something. Always, it's very rare that I have a plan set down thinking, right, well, I'm going to get the scammer to do this, this, and this. It really depends on what sort of reply they give me and what sort of feeling I get from these guys, how far they're willing to go for me.
I do want to ask you one question, though, that came to my mind as I was looking through this list of scammers who you've turned the tables on. All these guys in, largely, I guess, in Nigeria and places like that, holding Cote d'Ivoire, holding up signs, making them look foolish. Because here you are, this sort of well-educated white guy in Britain, getting these guys to go through these hoops. And mm-hmm. I just wonder if you ever worry that it sort of smacks of racism, that you get them making fools of themselves and then yeah. put them up on the sort of internet wall like you know, you're making fun of them.
Yeah, I can't lie. We do get emails every so often from disgruntled people. But it's a sad fact of life that the vast majority by far of scam emails do originate from Western and Southern Africa. I mean, We do have white Caucasian people on our site as well. In fact, we've got video footage of white scammers. But unfortunately, there is this fallacy that it's poor people who've got nothing better to do. You know, they've got nothing else to do in life. But what people must understand is that these guys, a lot of them work in big, highly organized groups, raking in tens of thousands of dollars a week, it's not just a couple of hundred dollars here every other month or something like that. They're making masses of money. I mean, we're talking literally hundreds upon hundreds of millions of dollars. One scammer contacted me about 2 years ago. I took him through the normal procedure, wasted his time over a period of about 3 months. And in that period, I actually sent him some faked passports of my own. And it ran on as usual, and 3 or 4 months later, he realized he was being anti-scammed, and he sent me a load of abuse, and that was the end of it. But about 4 months later, the same guy contacted me again. He congratulated me on how I'd done him over and said, you know, he was impressed with the job that I'd done with the fake passports and the fake paperwork that I sent to him. And then he said to me, how about you come working for me? Can you produce these passports for me, and I will pay you for these, and I will pay you $10,000 per month to actually provide these fake passports to him. So you've got to think to yourself, and it was a legitimate offer that he was making. He wasn't trying to fool me into something else.
Yeah.
And you've got to think to yourself, well, how much money is this guy making if he can afford to pay me $10,000 a month?
The point is that you're making is that you don't feel very sorry for these guys.
These are
not desperate attempts to eke out a living by exploiting the internet.
Yeah, you know, the worst these guys can expect is that their picture might appear on my website, for a laugh for people. Unfortunately, they're victims. I can count personally maybe 300 or 400 that have contacted me over the years. Their plight is a hell of a lot worse. People who've lost tens of thousands of dollars, they've lost homes, families, you name it. And there's some real horror stories out there.
I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Story. Mike Berry runs a website out of Manchester, England, where he's dedicated to striking back at email scammers. Mike has fun trying to create wild scenarios after he's strung along a scam artist. Here's one of them.
I told the guy, look, I'll pay you the money, give me a call on such and such a date, I'll be outside the Western Union office ready to make your payment, just confirm who you are and I'll make the payment straight away. So that's how it went. He wanted, I can't remember the exact amount, maybe $12,000-$13,000. He then called me and I'd pre-prepared some car sounds and some street sounds on my PC, ready to play on the phone. I was in the comfort of my own home. This guy rings me up. I start the recording and playing back the sound effects of cars beeping and horns, and basically convinced the guy who was stood outside the office, just on the verge of sending him his money.
Hello? Who's that?
This is Martins.
Oh, hello, Martins. Sorry about the noise. I'm actually outside. I'm just coming up to the Western Union office now.
Did you receive the fax?
Yes, I've got the fax in front. I've got the fax in front of me. Can you hear me through this noise?
Yes, I can hear you. Right. What are the names on the fax?
Yeah, the names I've got from you are... sorry, they're hard for me to read.
Oh, I understand. There are three names there, right?
Yes.
Okay, how long is it going to take you to respond back from Western Union?
What I'll do... Just one moment, my secretary's over there. David? Can you move from that... Move from that car, please. David? Move from the car! Move from the car!
And just as I was about to walk through the door, I got killed in a horrible motor accident. The guy was left hanging on the phone just saying, you know, where are you? Where are you? Are you okay? Are you okay? And he just thought I'd died and gone to heaven just on the verge of him getting his payment. And yeah, I've done that two or three times, similar type things. Another one where I actually got shot. and another one actually that I'm working on at the moment where... the guy's expecting me to send money and I phone him up and I'm in the middle of a bank holding the bank up to get the money to pay the guys fees, and I'll be gunned down by the security just as I'm coming out the bank door.
How many different scammers will you have on the line at any one given time?
Well, nowadays I don't tend to have as many as I used to. In the last 6 months, I sort of slowed down because, unfortunately, real life's getting in the way at the moment. But going back, say, 12 months, it wouldn't be unusual to have 10 or 15 on the go at any one time.
And how much of your own time were you putting into this, Mike?
In the early days, it would have been 7-8 hours a day, something like that. a lot of time, because you're corresponding with the scammers. I'm having to look at the site, look after the site, answer emails from members of the public, queries and things like that. So it was taking up a lot of my time. I'm spending maybe 2, maximum 3 hours a day now, probably.
And do you ever get the sense that you're making a difference, that you're, you know, slowing them down enough that you can take some satisfaction in that or helping people out in some way?
Most definitely. In fact, we have some hard evidence of that. At the beginning of September this year, our site and other anti-scam sites were, you know, you could say, victims of a DOS attack. In other words, the scammers had organized hundreds of thousands, millions of computers to actually log on to our site and other sites, basically to flood our site with information and bring the sites down. And a lot of sites were down for 2-3 months at a time. I mean, this DOS attack was costing these guys, we estimated, around about $2,000 or $3,000 a day to actually do it to us. And it went on for nearly 3 months solid. And we do know now that it was scammers who were actually paying, you know, some of the big guys were actually paying for this attack to try and bring us down and out of business.
And do you ever hear from people who spend time at your site and then get back to you and say, yeah, you saved me, you know, $5,000. I was going to send it to.
Yeah, I mean, the most recent case was a lady called Georgina in Minnesota. And she had been dealing with a scammer for about 4 or 5 weeks. And it got to the phase where she was taken in by his story, hook, line and sinker. She trusted him completely. He ended up asking her for just over $4,500 for fees. And she was just on the verge of getting to send this money. And she thought, something in the back of her head thought, well, I'd better check this guy out. So she typed his name into Google. And the first site that came up was our site. And she came to our site, recognised the format, and knew that this guy was basically taking her for a ride. And not a day goes by that I don't get emails from people who've been approached by scammers or have fallen for a scam. And generally speaking, the amount scammed is fairly low maybe $300-$400, something like that, mm-hmm. up to the highest amount that I've ever been in touch with a victim was $120,000. But no matter how small or large the amount, the impact is virtually the same. You know, the shock, you know, I put my trust in this guy, he was really nice to me, and then they can get extremely nasty. I mean, I've been on the receiving end of it as well. I mean, I've had death threats down the phone to me. Out of any of the people that have appeared on my site, scammer-wise, I wouldn't lose one second sleep over anybody thinking, well, you know, did I just go a bit too far with that guy, knowing how these guys operate and exactly what they can do with their victims.
Mike, thanks so much for being with us.
Not a problem. Thank you very much for having me.
Mike Berry is a computer engineer who joined me from Manchester, England. If you want to look through some more of the different scenarios that Mike has created to waste the time of the email scammers, we have a link to his website at thestory.org. And if you've come up with your own way to scam the scammers, let me know. If you go to thestory.org and drop me a note there, well, we'll read it. Promise me $1 million and I won't read it. I won't. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Story.
The Story is a production of North Carolina Public Radio, WUNC, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill.
American Public Media.